Were you given any particular assignment when you first arrived there, or were you just free at that point?
They usually left you alone to develop your own project, unless you wanted to go directly into some already going project. And in my case, they just left me alone to work in polymer physical chemistry. So I started out trying to see if I could devise new techniques for molecular size and shape. Light scattering by then was pretty well established, and there wasn't much obvious left to do with it. Of course, at that time we didn't have any lasers, so there's no laser light scattering to do. And so I started looking into various dynamic methods, which I got into because of something I'd done at Berkeley on the Kerr effect, electro-optical birefringence. That was at Berkeley with Chester T. Okonski, C.T. T. Okonski, O'Konski. He's still at Berkeley.
Were you...
That was an outgrowth of the light scattering, in a way.
Okay. Were you sensitive to practical applications while you were developing this? In terms of working for a company rather than being...
Yeah, well... My feeling was that if I could get a good alternative method for molecular weight size and shape, which were always very tedious methods, that it would be useful in the laboratory because there's a lot of polymer work going on there. Mm-hmm. Marshall had some 30 chemists, and he had most of them working on polymer things. But I didn't have, you might say, real immediate money-making practical ideas in mind. And in fact, I think that was one of the disappointments of my interaction with GE, is that nothing of that kind ever really did develop. I got one patent while I was there for a process of making polymers of uniform molecular weight, but it was not a commercially interesting process.
I noticed that during that period, which is, we're talking about 8 years, I guess, 52.
9 years, actually.
Okay,
51 through 60.
That you published at least 25 papers, maybe even more, which strikes me as being a rather large number for being at an industrial research lab.
Well, as I told you, it was a pure research environment, and only occasionally did we have to get involved with some project that wasn't leading to publishable results.
Was that unusual for the time, or was that common throughout other laboratories, industrial
labs? That was unusual. GE and Bell have always been unusual in that way, and more recently in IBM laboratories and maybe a few other places have been like that. But most industrial laboratories, that sort of thing is quite unusual. People do publishable, more or less fundamental work sort of on the side in other laboratories usually, whereas at GE you could make that your main effort and do other things on the side.
How many other, during that 8 year or 9 year period that you were there, was there much movement within the group, or was it pretty steady in terms of personnel?
There was considerable amount of turnover. As you noticed, I mentioned Price and I were always in the same group there, but the other people, there were three, Hoffman and then Gibbs and then Kilb. So there was a fair amount of turnover. And there was a fair amount of turnover in the rest of the physical chemistry group too, as people switched around from one project to another, new people came in and so forth. Yeah, I think it was unusual for anybody to stay on one project for more than 3 or 4 years, so it did happen.
Did Hoffman go to NBS after he left GE?
Yeah. He left GE, went to NBS.
You published at least one, maybe more papers with him.
At least one. We published a paper on thermal diffusion together. I think we must have published one or two others. I'm not quite sure now just what. When Hoffman was there, he wasn't much interested in working on polymers. He was interested in smaller molecule dielectrics. After he left GE, then polymers took a hold of him, and he got into polymers, where he's very firmly established today. So at that time, our research interests didn't overlap very closely, even though we were in the same laboratory.
I'm not clear on the dates now, but you started some work on DNA about the time that you left GE. I'm not sure if that started at GE or was after that.
It was just at the end. Just before leaving GE, I went to Yale for the spring semester as a visiting professor.
In the spring of 60?
Spring of 60. And at that point, I guess I wrote a first theoretical paper on DNA, and also met and collaborated with a fellow who was at Yale at the time named Bill William Ginoza, G-I-N-O-Z-A, who was doing experiments on DNA as transforming principle, that is, was carrying genetic information from one organism to another. I helped him interpret the experiments he was doing on the inactivation of this transforming principle by heat. In other words, a simple physical phase transition.
What led you to leave GE then?
Well, it was a growing interest in biochemistry on my part. I began to feel that polymer chemistry was moving pretty slowly. Certainly things like light scattering that I'd done a long time before were well out.
Excuse me, I think I might have left some stuff under here.
How did you set about looking for something then?
I had been acquainted with biochemistry before a little bit through contact with Stern at Brooklyn Polytechnic, with Calvin at Berkeley, and with Doty the year that I spent at Harvard. Doty was already working on DNA at that time. And then I got interested in helix coil transitions from the theoretical side, because I think I was invited to give a talk on it at Brooklyn Poly sometime in the late 50s, so I had to go to the literature and look up what there was, and found that there wasn't very much, and thought this was a subject that ought to be amenable to some fairly straightforward statistical mechanics. So I got into working on that, and that sort of rekindled my interest in the whole biopolymer field as opposed to the synthetic polymer one. And then I got invited to join a month-long workshop, they called it, at Colorado, which is run by NIH, in the spring, or at the summer of 1958. And that really brought me up to date on what was going on. So I determined to go into physical biochemistry, or polymer biochemistry, whatever you want to call it, from leaving synthetic polymer chemistry. So at that point, it seemed like it would be probably a good idea to leave GE, because while they didn't object to my doing this, there wasn't anything of that kind going on there, and it really didn't look like it would be a thing that would fit most comfortably into the laboratory. So I started to look around to see what opportunities there might be.
What were some of the places you were considering?
Well, it was Yale. We established contact with Berkeley, and then on my way out to see if people at Berkeley, I was invited to come out and give a talk, actually. I stopped off at Chicago, where Mayer was, and he said that he was seriously considering going to a new California campus at La Jolla. So I worked that into the schedule and flew down from Berkeley to see what it was all about. I also looked into Stanford, too. That was enough places to look at. I think of my mind.
You went there then in 1960, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There was a fellow from Yale, David Bonner, who was going there, too, from the biochemistry group at Yale. So that was one of the reasons I went to La Jolla.
What were the conditions at La Jolla when you arrived there?
Well, that was very interesting. It had been up to that point just an oceanographic station. They'd gotten a couple of new buildings. They'd gotten a, at that time, called a School of Science and Engineering, officially established, which didn't hardly physically exist yet. But at least they had gotten the paper formation of it. So they were recruiting chemists and physicists and biologists. So we came there and moved into a new oceanographic building, keeping the oceanographers out of it for a few years, and started the school up pretty much from scratch, except for the fact there was an oceanography graduate program already going there, so we had something to build on. But we had to set up a curricula completely and advertise around to get graduate students.
Did you find yourself back on committees again at this point?
Of course. Of course, yeah. I think by that time I had forgotten what it was like to be in the university.
Were you able to extricate yourself, or did that have you continued to be active?
It's pretty much impossible to extricate oneself completely, but after a few years I did succeed in toning it down. So.
Where were your sources of external support coming from?
First NSF and then NIH.
Any consulting?
Not to amount to anything. An occasional consulting trip, one or two times a year someplace, where somebody would come into town and want to consult right there. Mm-hmm. Instrumentation usually is what it was. I remember I went up to Beckman's operation in Fullerton once, and a guy came down from, I guess it was Hewlett-Packard, actually, and several other places like that. Aerojet General, I remember. Once or twice. They were all individual consulting things, not any long-lasting relationship.
Could you tell me something about your graduate students?
Well, the first graduate student we had in the department, and the first one I had at La Jolla, was Don Crothers, who is now a professor at Yale. C-R-O-T-H, you have an A in there, I think?
Yeah.
And he was, I guess he came partly because of my connection with Yale. The previous year he had been an undergraduate at Yale, though not at that time, but Harpst, H-A-R-P-S-T, and Neville Kallenbach. They're both physical chemists, K-A-L-L-E-N-B-A-C-H. Harpst is now at Case Western Reserve, Kallenbach's at University of Pennsylvania. So they and Don Crothers were, and Rodney Harrington was also a postdoc. He's from the University of Washington, Seattle. He's now at the University of Nevada in Reno. They were the initial group at La Jolla. And then other people came in from time, gradually.
And as I see Harrington's name here, did some polymer degradation work.
Yeah.
But you started building instruments again, too, didn't you? Or another?
Yeah, well, we needed instruments to do things. My old white sky instrument was still at Berkeley in a storeroom, and I went up there with my station wagon in June, I think, of the first year, and with the help of a couple of people there, dug it out of the storeroom, loaded it in the car, and brought it back, what there was left of it anyway, which was most of it. And then we needed other things. You can't do experimental work on physical chemistry without instruments. There was no very good way of measuring the viscosity of DNA solutions at that time. DNA is a very difficult thing to measure viscosity because molecules are so big they just deform very easily in flow. So we were trying to think of a good way of doing it, and I was washing the dishes at home one night, and I had a drinking glass in the sink full of water, and another glass happened to be sitting inside a somewhat smaller glass, which had a glass which had a heavy, very heavy knob of glass on the bottom, so it was properly weighted. And I was just floating there and slowly turning around, and it occurred to me that the only thing that was opposing that turning was the viscosity of the liquid in between. So that was the genesis of a rotating cylinder viscometer, which we then succeeded in putting together in the laboratory. Brothers and I worked very well for DNA solutions. People still use it once in a while. So that was an instrument. What else do we do? At GE, I'd put quite a lot of time in on viscoelasticity. I started to talk about that before. Dynamic methods of measuring molecular size and shape. And I thought of the various possibilities, considering a number of them, I thought viscoelasticity was probably one of the most practical because it's a big effect to measure. So I actually built an instrument at GE to do this and developed some theory to understand what was going on. And after going to La Jolla, a couple of the later postdocs I had thought it would be interesting to follow this up with DNA. Actually, the guy who was most interested in doing that was Stanley Gill, who was taking a sabbatical there. Stan Gill is at Colorado. And he had, how do you spell it? It's two L's,
right? Yeah.
He had done viscoelasticity experiments when he was working, I think, in the Army Research Laboratory somewhere shortly after the war. So it occurred to him it would be interesting to do this on DNA. So when he came to La Jolla, in anticipation of his coming, I bought a flow by refringence instrument, which is very closely related to the phenomenon. And he and another younger postdoc named Doug Thompson from MIT succeeded in using it to measure dynamic flow by refringence with DNA solutions. And this suggested it would be good to measure dynamic viscoelasticity. So Thompson actually started to modify our viscometer to do it. And then he left, and a graduate student, Lynn Klotz, took it over, LynnKlotz. That's a male Lynn, not a female Lynn. Lynn Klotz took it over for his thesis and did a very good job of it, and we got a really working instrument out of it, which we were able to measure DNA relaxation times. And finally, sort of a long culmination to the thing I started at GE 20 years before, actually, by that time, I succeeded in really using it as a technique for size and shape measurements on DNA. So that was a long haul.
Yeah, so that some of those papers were just published not too many years ago, right? Is that correct?
Klotz's thesis was published in 1971, I think. The work was followed up by another postdoc, Ruth Kavanoff, who succeeded in doing more spectacular work measuring chromosome sizes. That's a K-A-V.
Okay.
Kavanoff, K-A-V-E-N-O-F-F.
Okay.
succeeded in measuring the size of the DNA from chromosomes of Drosophila fruit flies, which showed that one piece of DNA went with one chromosome, which up that time had been something geneticists are like to believe, but there was no demonstration of it.
Up for a moment, there is one thing that you wrote that intrigued me at the very end of the Annual Reviews of Physical Chemistry article. You said the circumstances surrounding the first publications of the determination of the molecular weight of polymers are curious from a bibliographic
view. Well, as I say there, the war confused the whole publication situation. So most of the Devise work, for example, was in unpublished reports, and there was just one short paper in the Journal of Applied Physics. And I think a later paper considerably after the war was over. So there was verbal stuff. Devise came and gave a lecture at Brooklyn, for example, I remember, after I'd been there a few months. And we took the best notes we could from his lecture.
How was he as a lecturer?
Oh, he was, Devise was an excellent lecturer. He was one of the best I've ever heard. He was in a very high class, above 90% or more of lecturers. Beautifully organized, very fluent. The only problem was you thought you understood everything while he was talking. And after he got through and he went back and tried to repeat it to somebody else, he realized that Devise understood it, but you didn't.
I was also intrigued by the fact that in 1946 you said you received unexpected reprints of Raman's paper.
Yeah.
Did you ever find out what precipitated that?
Not directly. I can just guess that he saw or heard about our work, maybe from Herman Mark. I know he visited Mark at one time. Maybe Mark saw him in India. And anyway, all of a sudden, reprint arrives in the mail. I think Doty got one also. Maybe Mark got one. I know there's more than some other people besides myself. But anyway. Yes, that was that. It was way back there whenever Raman wrote that in the late 20s or something.
27, yes.
It could have been used at that time. It was all there.
But like Gibbs with thermodynamics, it was not in a publication that was.
Well, it was in the Indian Journal of Physics or something. I don't suppose hardly anybody saw it. The people who could have used it would have been Mark, for example. I guess he never saw it. Mark had a research group in Germany. He had several different research. He had he could have very well gotten somebody to work on this if they had seen the thing.
What changes have you seen in your career in polymers? What would you say are the most significant changes that you've observed?
Well, there have been a number of a great many new polymers, of course. There have been new polymerization methods. The Ziegler-Natta thing came on in the 50s. When I started out working with polymers, about the only way anybody ever polymerized anything was with radical polymerization. So there have been a great many developments on the synthetic side, and then there have been a lot of technical developments, gel permeation, chromatography, the use of NMR. But actually, there's been remarkably little that has changed. There's been a lot of additions to the things we used to do back in the 40s. But a lot of them are still done. People still use light scattering. They still use osmometers. They certainly still use viscosity techniques.